Grab a chair. We're in a community meeting room, the kind you've seen 100 times in 100 towns. Burnt coffee, folding chairs, and the faint smell of dust and old wood that never quite leaves municipal buildings. People file in, already braced for conflict. At the front of the room, a map of the neighborhood hangs crooked on a board, creased, taped, loved a little too long. Next to it, architectural renderings in muted earth tones displaying 88 new apartment units. There is a pocket park and a modest courtyard that catches late afternoon sun. Half the units are income restricted, a kind gesture that lets teachers live near their schools and line cooks sleep near their stoves. Then, the microphone clicks on. A man in a windbreaker steps up first. He's cordial. He compliments the architect, but expresses concern about neighborhood character. A woman in a cardigan follows. "Safety," she says softly. "Parking," a little louder. Someone reads traffic counts like scripture. Another waves a thick binder, historical designation studies printed that morning from a website no one's heard of. The room fills with words that sound like planning, but land like protection. Setbacks, shadow studies, emergency access, wrong project, wrong place. No one says it directly, but they never have to. The sentiment is clear: not in my backyard. The phrase feels ancient, but it's younger than it sounds. On November 6, 1980, a reporter named Emily Travel-Levezzi filed a story for the Christian Science Monitor about hazardous waste sites. Her headline crystallized a century of local resistance into those four words: not in my backyard. The acronym NIMBY had surfaced earlier that year in a Virginia paper, a nickname still on a trial run. Levezzi didn't invent the instinct. She formalized the name that planners, journalists, and activists would rally around or weaponize. A few years later, the term grew barbs, wielded to suit self-interest like a Swiss Army knife. Nicholas Ridley, Margaret Thatcher's environment secretary, used NIMBY as a public shaming tool, mocking English villagers who blocked housing and incinerators. British tabloids amplified the fight, spreading the tactic and term across the Atlantic. Then Ridley did what power often does. He opposed low-income housing near his own Cotswold estate. Just like that, NIMBY meant two things at once: resistance and hypocrisy. But the political economy that locked the pattern in place arrived in California in 1978. Proposition 13, spearheaded by Howard Jarvis, capped property taxes. The 75-year-old businessman, lobbyist, and politician captured Californians with the fiery language of political firebrands like Joseph McCarthy and Newt Gingrich, stirring up and directing frustrations and anger towards government.
Government is filled with moochers and loafers right up to their ears, and they have a great idea. The object of a lot of them is to get the job and sit there till they get a pension. And in the meantime, don't move in any direction. And if you think that isn't so, just go over there this morning to the city council's office, and you walk through 15 city councilmen's office. You'll see more people asleep and reading Playboy than you do in a hotel.
Jarvis, originally from Utah, purchased a home in California in the 1930s for $8,000, and by 1976, it was assessed at $80,000, which clearly didn't sit right with him. Prop 13 set out to limit property tax rates to 1% of 1976 assessed values, restrict annual increases to a maximum of 2%, and required supermajorities for future tax hikes. Reassessment would only happen when property changed hands or new construction was completed. The measure swept the state and became not just untouchable, but politically radioactive to challenge. California homeowners cheered and retirees exhaled, and the country was watching closely.
This is going to be introduced pretty soon in Michigan, Oklahoma, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania that I know about. I might say that I get calls from the BBC. I might say that I got an invitation to go to Canada. They want to start it there. And the thing is just sweeping the country, and it's beyond my capacity to really comprehend it, if you want to know the truth about it.
Jarvis was associated with the Los Angeles Apartment Owners Association. During the Prop 13 campaign, a key argument to shore up the non-homeowner vote was that lowering property tax rates would cause landlords to pass savings on to renters who were upset at their rapidly rising rents driven by the high inflation of the 1970s. As you might expect by now, the windfall went to the owners, and most renters did not see that savings. This betrayal eventually helped fuel a push for rent control. But for Prop 13, consider this. It actually functioned like rent control itself, but for owners. While critics of rent control argue that when prices are capped, supply shrinks and quality erodes, that same logic was not considered for property taxes. So the longer you own your property, the bigger your subsidy grew. And for homeowners, selling, especially to downsize, stopped making sense. Turnover slowed, supply tightened. Risk leapfrogged the ownership class onto governments, which meant back to the citizens. When property taxes disconnect from value and inflation, governments are forced to source revenue elsewhere. Development and new housing fees rise first because they're politically easy. They hit future residents and builders, not current voters. New housing gets more expensive before a shovel hits the ground, reinforcing NIMBY arguments that projects are financially infeasible. Housing, especially housing that doesn't pay its way up front, starts to look like a fiscal liability. Governments can also increase sales and consumption taxes, municipal service and user fees, fines, penalties and code enforcement, school and family-related fees, infrastructure and transportation charges, business fees and licensing, and special assessments and district fees like Melrose here in California. Existing homeowners, now protected from rising tax bills, realize that every new unit will require services that their capped taxes won't easily fund. So to avoid increases elsewhere, slogans like protect our schools, keep our streets safe from traffic, and even save our green spaces pretty much just means no new neighbors. Proposition 13 didn't invent NIMBYism, it legalized it. 4 decades later, the playbook is refined. With lawsuits as strategy and appeals as habit, environmental rhetoric gets repurposed. The alliances get strange, but the outcomes are expected. And the money? There's always lots of money involved. In San Francisco, Proposition B rode a wave of cash from wealthy donors to block mid-rise development on the waterfront, framed as view protection. It passed with nearly 59% of the vote. In Los Angeles, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation poured millions into Measure S, an anti-growth initiative dressed as reform, then backed Our Neighborhood Voices to claw back upzoning statewide. On the peninsula, at Cypress Point and Moss Beach, an unlikely detractor of a 100% affordable housing project was a Sierra Club chapter, proof that location can prevent desperately needed housing density and affordable units. Elsewhere, cities brag about resisting state housing mandates while quietly bleeding taxpayer dollars on lawsuits and fines. Realtor boards, small property owners, and sometimes trade unions bankroll neighborhood protection campaigns when new supply threatens leverage. Now back in our meeting room, the ending is predictable. The project gets tabled, downsized, or delayed. The pocket park disappears. The courtyard shrinks. Units get cut. Studios replace family-sized apartments. And somewhere else, further out across a county line, a field becomes an hour-long commute because this room said no. To understand why this keeps happening, you have to step back more than a century, back to Thorstein Veblen. At the turn of the 20th century, Veblen argued that economies weren't driven by rational need or collective progress, but by social emulation, by people signaling status through what they owned, what they avoided, and what they could afford not to do. He called it conspicuous consumption and conspicuous leisure, the public display of waste as proof of worth, expensive objects masquerading as taste, idleness masquerading as success, scarcity, not utility, as prestige. Veblen said something economists preferred not to hear. People don't just want shelter, education, or goods. They want rank, and institutions under influence evolve to protect it. That insight lands squarely in the housing market a century later. By the 2010s, cities weren't just places to live. They were symbols to curate. Neighborhoods became brands. Views became assets. Height limits, parking minimums, and historic character hardened into tools of exclusion, defended not as protectionism, but as preservation. NIMBYism wasn't accidental. It was leisure class conservatism in modern form, freezing the built environment to preserve social position. New construction skewed luxury not because developers misunderstood need, but because prestige sets the price ceiling. Rooftop pools, co-working lounges, dog spas, these weren't indulgences, they were signals. Tech office perks bled into housing because both competed for the same class identity. Waste became marketable. Amenity replaced affordability. Global capital followed easily. Homes became slots in a portfolio. Towers became safety deposit boxes in the sky. Empty units weren't failures. They were stores of value. The creative class arrived as cultural cover, while longtime residents were priced out and pushed aside. So, from Gilded Age millionaires like John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, and Cornelius Vanderbilt, to modern billionaires like Elon Musk, Larry Page, and Jeff Bezos, wealth concentrates because the entire social structure trains us to admire their image, protect it, and futilely chase it, even when it hurts us. Veblen argued that the economy serves two functions: meet society's material needs while generating profit for those who control production. But socially, those functions split. For most working people, you're told that respect comes from working hard and being useful. Having a job and doing it well is how you earn status. But here's the rub. For the wealthy leisure class, what brings respect is not having to work and showing that you have time and money to spare. With that dichotomy on display, discontent is bound to brew below the surface. But Veblen noticed that even though luxury items are meant for the rich, people with less money still try to copy them. They buy expensive things or lifestyles not because they need them, but because they want the leisure class's level of importance and respect. A relationship of admiration, emulation, and blind hope quells frustrations enough to keep up the charade. But when paths to wealth and status are under pressure, how much can the system take? Veblen warned that when status governs institutions, progress stalls. The instinct to build collides with the instinct to conserve rank. And in housing, that collision defined an era. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Built to Divide.
We are seeing one of the greatest human migrations of all time. As members of this creative economy, highly educated and highly skilled people move to no more than a half dozen to a dozen mega regions in the United States, and perhaps another 10 worldwide. Our economic fortune, like it or not, is structured around about 25 mega regions worldwide.
Well, if we think the American dream is embodied in a suburban home with a yard and a white picket fence, then I think we're making the American dream much more accessible.
Rent your American dream.
You can rent the American dream.
Last time we followed the migration from ownership to access. we watched how subscription logic born in technology slipped into housing, how the foreclosure crisis opened a door for build to rent, how capital fell in love with rent as a river instead of sales as a storm, and how a culture tired of debt learned to call flexibility freedom, sometimes until the bill came due. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all of the episodes of this series in order. As an architect, I have heard many reasons and excuses for rising housing costs, from inside the industry and from neighbors at the mic. Some are honest, some are camouflage, but all of them add up. Today, we examine the 2010s, where every facet of the housing industry is under pressure, all at once. We'll trace the evolution of NIMBYism's favorite tool in California, CEQA, look at why new construction skews luxury, how tech office perks leaked into apartment amenities, and what those choices do to the block and the budget. We'll talk gentrification and displacement, empty towers as safety deposit boxes in the sky, Hudson Yards and the creative class, and the way global capital treats homes as slots in a portfolio. And we'll get into all of that after the break. Episode 9, Under Pressure. Once NIMBY entered the lexicon, it did two things. It gave reformers a clean word for localized obstruction, and it gave opponents a reason to fortify. A label can clarify a conflict, but it can also harden it. And over time, the word began to do more hiding than revealing. Because NIMBYism isn't just a temperament, it's a structure. In California, that structure was set in concrete by Proposition 13, which rewired local incentives to distrust new housing. When property taxes can't rise with value and inflation, growth stops looking like opportunity and starts looking like risk. New residents means new services, schools, streets, sewers, without the revenue to pay for them. Preservation becomes fiscal prudence. Resistance becomes rational. But the movement found a powerful tool, moral cover. That cover came from the environmental movement, one of the most consequential and well-intentioned political awakenings in American history. The 1960s and early 1970s marked an explosion of ecological consciousness. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, then later the Clean Air Act, the Water Quality Act, and the Whole Earth Catalog. By January 1st, 1970, President Richard Nixon signed the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, requiring federal agencies to study and disclose the environmental impacts of their actions through formal environmental impact statements. California followed 9 months later. On September 18, 1970, then-Governor Ronald Reagan signed the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, into law. Like NEPA, it required environmental review. However, CEQA made stopping projects easier. Under NEPA, a project with serious environmental harm can still proceed as long as the damage is disclosed. CEQA gave courts, agencies, and ultimately private litigants the power to halt projects altogether. Transparency became leverage. And that leverage was first tested in a case that began not with cynicism, but with concern. In 1971, a developer proposed a large condominium and retail project in Mammoth Lakes. Local residents worried about water, sewage, and the loss of open space. They formed a group, Friends of Mammoth, and sued Mono County, arguing that the project shouldn't move forward without a full environmental review. In 1972, the California Supreme Court agreed. In Friends of Mammoth v. Board of Supervisors, the court extended CEQA beyond public works to cover private development as well. Any project requiring a government permit, which is to say nearly all of them, would now require environmental review. Limiting review to public projects, the court said, would, quote, frustrate the effectiveness of the act, end quote. Environmental considerations had to shape all government decision-making. The ruling included a caveat. Only projects with significant environmental impacts should trigger the full weight of CEQA. But the court never defined significant. Local governments, fearing lawsuits, did what bureaucracies always do under ambiguity. They slowed everything down. Permits stalled, reviews multiplied, banks watching timelines stretch from months into years began to avoid financing projects that could be trapped in litigation purgatory. Later that year, the court tried to narrow the interpretation, but the damage was already done. CEQA had become a procedural choke point, and NIMBYs learned to use it. What began as a shield for ecosystems became a sword against density. Sue for an air quality report, challenge the traffic study, or demand another shadow analysis. If you can stall for 5 years or more, the financing window closes.
Normally, if you sue a public agency, your odds are not good. Think about suing the IRS. How many of those lawsuits are you going to really win? Not too many. And that's by design. We don't want people to sue the IRS. We want people to pay their taxes. So we make the requirements clear. That's a rule of law. You can't have a rule of law if you don't know what the law requires. And what CEQA has always been, remember CEQA 1970, Beatles were together, Nixon, Reagan, it was like a different time. We didn't have the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Coastal Act. We didn't have modern environmental law. It was only CEQA and the national analog, NEPA. And in that world, judges and advocates on both sides, as well as agencies, had to invent stuff. And in that invention world, when this law was first emerging, it was kind of case by case, right? Is this enough? Is this too much? Maybe this should be different. That ethic in litigation continues, which means, as a couple really noted experts on the CEQA preservationist side have noted, it is entirely unpredictable to predict, to kind of think about what are the odds in court. Because of that unpredictability, the threat of a CEQA lawsuit has a lot of power.
This is a clip from the State of Gold podcast in an interview with Jennifer Hernandez, a land use and an environmental attorney at Holland & Knight. A 2015 study by Holland & Knight found that only 13% of CEQA lawsuits were brought by groups with any prior record of environmental advocacy, half targeted publicly funded projects with no private sector sponsor. The most frequent targets weren't polluters, but mass transit projects. The very infrastructure that not only reduces per capita emissions and air pollution, but makes density more feasible. The study found that CEQA was often used to block the state's own environmental goals. CEQA lawsuits have stalled infill housing in Sacramento, solar farms in San Diego, and transit in San Francisco. Often, the mere threat of a lawsuit is enough to kill a project before it begins, especially housing. Environmental law didn't fail. It was repurposed, and money followed the opportunity. Neighborhood groups sprouted overnight, complete with 501c3s and PACs. Donor lists revealed the strange coalitions. Landlords worried about competition, trade locals wary of non-union crews, boutique hoteliers who oppose Airbnb and apartments alike, and tech millionaires insisting the schools will collapse if a duplex appears next door. But by the mid-2010s, a growing counter-movement had a name of its own, YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard. Renters, young families, climate advocates, and workers priced out of the cities that they power organized around a simple claim: housing scarcity is a choice. Yard signs now dueled in the same planter. At city councils, chants collided. Protect our neighborhood versus homes for people, not just cars. YIMBY strategy sharpened behind the Housing Accountability Act, a 1982 California state law designed to promote infill development by speeding housing approvals. Renters organized as a voting bloc, shifted power from district-captured councils to citywide elections, and push for by right approvals near transit and jobs. The Housing Accountability Act was strengthened by subsequent amendments in 1990, 2017, and 2024. But while the NIMBY versus YIMBY signs fought for attention, something quieter and more decisive was happening inside the cost stack. If you built anything since 2010, you felt it. Land prices in job-rich metros surged. Lumber whipsawed, steel climbed, concrete, gypsum, copper. None of them got cheaper. After the financial crisis, the construction workforce shrank and never fully recovered. Skilled trades retired, immigration policy tightened, and younger workers, steered toward four-year degrees, drifted away from the trades, driving up labor costs. Inevitably, whenever costs rise, someone will blame immigration as if the very people who pour our slabs and hang our doors set the price of plywood. The reality, however, is boring. Construction relies on immigrant labor, especially in the trades. Tightening immigration reduces labor supply, which raises costs and slows delivery. If you want more housing, you want more skilled trades. Through apprenticeship pipelines, vocational education, and immigration channels that respect and reward the people who actually swing hammers. A labor shortage met material inflation and married into a zoning regime that asked for two parking spaces where a bus should suffice. At the same time, the population plateau in parts of the country hit a key fact. Housing formation patterns matter more for housing demand than crude headcounts. Later marriages, more single adult households, and aging in place all increase unit demand per capita. Add in the investor shift to single-family rentals. You really eat up the supply.
We're expanding. I mean, when you think about it, we have an incredible amount of demand for what we do. So, Leslie, in any given week, we might have 200 or 300 homes available.
For renting.
For renting. And we get about 10,000 leasing inquiries a week.
This is a clip from 60 Minutes with host Leslie Stahl interviewing Gary Berman, CEO of Tricon Residential, a Toronto-based company that rents single-family homes in the U.S.
So today, we own about 30,000 single-family rental homes across the U.S., largely in the Sun Belt, and we've got probably about 75,000 people living in our homes.
Millennials, debt-loaded and late to buy, crowd the rental market longer.
Well, if we think the American dream is embodied in a suburban home with a yard and a white picket fence, then I think we're making the American dream much more accessible.
Rent your American dream.
You can rent the American dream.
The result? Demand for certain kinds of housing stays hot. Near jobs, transit, schools, even as overall population growth cools. All of this creates what developers call a pro forma squeeze. Your hard costs, materials and labor, and soft costs, fees, design, finance, balloon while achievable rents or sales prices can't rise fast enough across the whole market to keep pace. In many jurisdictions, it only pencils, that is, generates a return that banks and equity partners will fund at the top end. Are there alternative design solutions? Yes. Smaller units, modular and panelized construction, mass timber, reducing parking minimums from 2 spaces per unit to 1 or 0, especially near transit, pre-approved plan sets and standardized details, missing middle forms, duplexes, fourplexes, courtyard housing that slot into residential fabrics without the visual shock new towers can bring. But for each of these, the zoning code, fire code, or neighborhood opposition can turn one step forward into 3 steps sideways. Behind council and community debates, CEQA analysis, rising costs, and shrinking supply, every delay raises risk. Every appeal adds carrying costs. Every year of uncertainty narrows the pool of lenders willing to play. The result is a funnel. Only projects large enough to absorb friction survive. And that's how choice disappeared. Not because people didn't need housing, but because the system made building it expensive, slow, and fragile. By the time a project cleared the gauntlet, it had to be big, high rent, and overinsured just to pencil out. So when you see a rendering with a rooftop deck and a dog spa and a co-working lounge, you're not just seeing an architect or developer gone wild. You're seeing a margin defense. That lounge rents the building for $175 more per month. The pet spa attracts the tenant who renews consistently. The extras signal what's called Class A asset, convincing lenders that risk is lower, which cuts interest costs just enough to tip a red spreadsheet black. Now, there's no federal statute that defines luxury. In the industry, we use proxies. High initial asking rents, amenity sets, and high-quality finishes. By those measures, the post-2012 pipeline skewed unmistakably toward the top. Analysis of large apartment buildings found that roughly 79% of 2017 deliveries and 87% of 2018 deliveries landed in the high-end bucket. The Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies has tracked the same trend. Recently, multifamily completions concentrate in bigger, amenity-rich buildings at higher asking rents. Data shops like RealPage show record apartment deliveries from 2023 to 2025, with Class A product performing closest to lender expectations. Now let's dig further into why. As we've discussed, with steep land, material, labor, and development costs, you either build bigger, spread fixed costs, or you don't build. Bigger buildings almost always mean structured parking, excavation, lots of expensive concrete and formwork, elevators, more code complexity, pushing you further into Class A amenities and finishes just to justify and cover the costs of the box. Zoning restrictions and land scarcity in job-rich areas also push developers to maximize revenue per legal square foot. So if you can only build 5 stories where demand would support 10, you push each unit's rent to the ceiling. After the financial crisis, lenders and equity partners favored institutional quality projects. They'd rather back 220 upscale units downtown than 28 modest ones scattered across 3 parcels. Vacancy rates, whether through actual occupancy or investment, are usually lower at the top in tight markets, which matters to debt underwriters. Delayed home buying and income growth for the upper class meant a ready audience for luxury rentals. In tech hubs especially, Class A occupancy rebounded quickly after shocks. And while we provide some housing support through low-income housing tax credits and project-based vouchers, we don't do much for the middle. So the private market fills the top, the public sector barely helps the bottom, the middle gets squeezed like toothpaste. Cultural changes also contributed to the shift towards luxury. In the early 2000s, Richard Florida popularized the idea that the creative class, knowledge workers, artists, techies, drove urban revival.
When you divide the economy into 3 pieces, 3 sectors, manufacturing, service, and creative, the creative sector of the economy accounts for more than 50% of all wages and salaries paid. We will generate, as we lose another 500,000 jobs in manufacturing, we will generate over the next decade another 10 million jobs in the creative economy. And those jobs are not distributing themselves evenly. They're concentrating, as I will tell you in a minute. They are concentrating in particular places. As I wrote recently for the Atlantic Monthly, we are seeing one of the greatest human migrations of all time. As members of this creative economy, highly educated and highly skilled people move to no more than a half dozen to a dozen mega regions in the United States and perhaps another 10 worldwide. Our economic fortune, like it or not, is structured around about 25 mega regions worldwide.
Now, people don't pay enough attention to the influence that the creative class, specifically the tech industry, had on building design. By the mid-2010s, apartments weren't just places to sleep. They were brand experiences. Co-working nooks, podcast rooms, barista bars, dog spas, cold storage package lockers, wellness suites, and maker spaces. If it sounds like an office perk list circa 2014, that's because the cultures converged. Google Kitchens and WeWork lounges reset expectations for what space should feel like. Casual, social, service-rich. Cities listened. Bike lanes, galleries, coffee shops, live-work lofts, and zoning overlays that made makerspaces out of warehouses. Multifamily developers mirrored that vibe to rent to the same talent pool. Design language followed, the hotelification of real estate. Lobbies began to look like boutique hotels. Leasing offices began to behave like concierge desks. Programming, yoga nights, food trucks, plant swaps, sold community, even as leases remained 12 months long. Some of this is harmless, turning dead space into useful rooms. Some of it is expensive, which pushes rents. All of it is signal. Amenity checklists say to lenders and tenants alike, this is the top of the stack. And in a capital regime that prices risk to the 0.01%, those signals open financing windows that otherwise slam shut, but add up the incentive to build at the top with the local appetite to block anything in the middle, and you get the barbell economy we live inside. Subsidized units where we fight like hell for a handful of lottery slots, and glossy buildings where we either stretch beyond prudence or walk away. In between, longtime tenants face renovations they can't afford and rents they can't match. The creative class idea had truth. Talent clusters matter. But the policy version too often sprayed amenities and hoped affordable housing would magically follow. It didn't. In some places, the creative class thesis helped rationalize gentrification without a housing plan, deepening exclusion even as it sold vibrancy. But gentrification is a progression, not a singular villain to strike. It arrives in stages. First, a coffee shop, a yoga studio, and a promise that it's all fine. Then a condo conversion. Then higher assessments. Then a landlord who decides to test vacancy decontrol. Then someone's aunt who has to move back in with cousins an hour away. The displacement is both direct, evictions, buyouts, rent hikes, and indirect. Neighborhoods become unaffordable to the next wave of the same working class that made them vibrant. In New York, sheer spectacle makes the contradictions easy to see. Towers along 57th Street as safety deposit boxes in the sky. Investment properties with their blinds forever drawn while working class tenants in walk-ups see rents jump as the neighborhood brand rises. In San Francisco, luxury micro-units sprout near offices, even as teachers carpool from Vallejo. In Austin, cranes bloom alongside tents. If you want a monument to the 2010s development psyche, take a stroll through Hudson Yards, a large-scale redevelopment program in Manhattan. Stephen Ross, chair of Related Companies, shepherded the redevelopment of rail yards into a gleaming plateau of glass and steel, a city within a city with its own zip code swagger.
There was a lot of talk at that point about the High Line, but we knew that that also was going forward. The Hudson River Park, we didn't know for sure, but we thought that there would be a renovation of the Javits. So you could just see the things that were evolving around that site, and knowing that in Chelsea, even at that point, that was a very strong market. It's where the young people wanted to be.
Hudson Yards is impressive. Engineering on a massive platform over tracks. Stores that sell nothing you need, restaurants that plate art, an observation deck for Instagram, and office towers for firms that live on spreadsheets. It's also a parable. The financing stack leveraged public subsidies and tax breaks designed to spur growth. The product largely targets the global elite, luxury condos and high-end retail, while the surrounding boroughs grapple with repair backlogs and public housing and schools that can't hire counselors. It's not that Ross did anything illegal. It's that the system asked him to do exactly this. New York wanted a private solution to a public problem, vacant rail yards. So it wrote the terms that would make the solution happen. The outcome reflects the inputs. Capital went where the return was. And Hudson Yards is not unique, but how do we harness private horsepower for public purpose without giving away control? As we've established, beneath the politics, labor, and supply pressures of housing, financialization has transformed the purpose of housing altogether. Homes are no longer just shelter, they're assets, both for families trying to build stability and increasingly for investors trying to build returns. In the 2010s, global capital hunted yield in safe cities. Buying a condo in London, Vancouver, New York, or Miami became a way to park money in a rule of law regime. Some owners rented them out, but many didn't. An empty homes phenomenon took hold in high amenity neighborhoods. Lots of lights off, lots of land values up. Some local governments experimented with vacancy taxes, while developers pitched global lifestyle brands as if a city were a resort. The portfolio city emerges. Towers owned by funds that report to pension boards continents away. Cul-de-sacs owned by LLCs. iBuyers, companies that purchase residential properties directly from private sellers, then flip suburban homes with algorithms. And Airbnb, turning neighborhoods into hotels on long weekends. When a place becomes a bundle of instruments, the decisions that shape it drift away from the people who actually live there. Is building luxury inherently bad and useless for affordability? Not entirely. New units are new units. And over time, as buildings age and compete with newer stock, they do eventually filter down the price spectrum. Multiple analysis, Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies and Pew, find that adding supply, even at the high end, tempers rent growth in older, more affordable stock nearby. But it doesn't meet demand fast enough. While every unit is necessary, just luxury is not enough. To address the issue, we need to lower production costs, open more sites, and add middle-income tools so we don't keep producing only at the top. That means letting fourplexes bloom in places zoned for only single family. It means cutting parking minimums where people can realistically live without a second car and green lighting mass transit projects so they can. It means permitting by right so every project doesn't have to survive 12 gladiator rounds of discretionary review. Housing security policy is also necessary where people will otherwise get pushed out before supply has time to catch up. That means that residents need a right to counsel and stronger just cause eviction rules. Rent stabilization is needed where legal, and building programs need to target what the market won't: deep affordability and the missing middle. This isn't an ideological wish list, it's a practical one. If we want a country where teachers, truck drivers, line cooks, nurses, grad students, and retired bus operators can live in the places they serve, this is the work in front of us. Because beneath every policy fight sits the same engine: wealth built through property and the weight of housing borne by those locked out of ownership. Both ends of that system reinforce the same divide. What we've seen are doors slammed shut on Black families by redlining, contract sales, and discrimination that still shows up in today's numbers. Even life-saving solutions like Housing First get distorted as public dollars meant to solve homelessness get misdirected. Media trains neighbors to despise one another. Algorithms quietly coordinate rent hikes. Software replaces collusion with code. Meanwhile, design innovations, microhousing, modular construction, passive house, net zero, even 3D printed homes are solutions that miss the actual problem. And powerful institutions like the 1.5 million member National Association of Realtors continue to shape the rules, resisting upzoning today while apologizing for segregation yesterday. So here's the edge we're standing on. If property remains America's primary wealth machine, what happens when half the country is permanently priced and programmed out of ownership? When the latter still exists, but rungs are missing by design. That's where we're headed, next time on Built to Divide.
The deconstruction of the administrative state, which is a huge element. Remember, you got two forms of populism. You have right-wing populism, you have left-wing populism. Right-wing populism is about deconstruction of the administrative state. Bernie Sanders and AOC is about more inclusion of the state. We're both populists, but they want more state intervention. We want less. In fact, we want to start to take apart certain parts of the apparatus.
Thanks for listening. Built to Divide is presented by Lines, my architecture and creative studio. This podcast is produced in collaboration with Gable Media. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find it. And if you're looking for similar content, Built to Divide is part of the Gable Media Network, where you can find even more like this. Visit GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, video clips, and content that went into this episode, you can visit me at lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.
Oh, this is the most brilliant of the rooms that we've seen. I can see why they call it the Red Room. What is the fabric?
It's silk with a scroll border of gold. It's copied from an American Empire document. Everything in this room is Empire because the style of the room is dictated by the mantelpiece, which is Empire. This is one of the only two remaining mantels in the White House. 1817, after the fire. All the ones before were burned, and all the others in the house are either 1902 or 48. You see, it has the same Egyptian columns as the pier table we saw in the hall. That was because of Napoleon's Egyptian campaign and his desire to think of himself as a Roman emperor, have very heavy things.
That's American Empire in furniture, not in politics.
That's right. And this room has a beautiful carpet.